You're listening to The Perth Property Show, Australia's only weekly property podcast by West Australian experts for West Australian listeners. Catch your latest episode every Monday at 7 a.m.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome to The Perth Property Show. My name's Trent Fleskins, your host. As always, this week we have another leader in this industry. She wears many hats, but the first and foremost hat she wears is Managing Director of CLE Town Planning. It is Jane Bennett. Jane, thank you so much for coming in.
Thanks for having me today, Trent.
Mate, we've spent probably an hour and a half before even recording this morning having such a fantastic conversation about the industry. Clearly, both of us are very passionate about where things are at, the delivery of housing and planning in general in Western Australia. And I can't wait to hear your thoughts today. But first off, I thought we would get a little story from you about how things started, I'm assuming at university maybe, how someone goes to being the managing director of a town planning firm, but also deputy chair of the WAPC, sitting on the board in DevWA, sitting on the board in the future of Fremantle organisation. It's a lot of hats. Where did it all start?
Thanks, Trent. It's really exciting to be here. And I think it's a really exciting time for all of us in property in WA with the rate of change that's going on at the moment. My property pathway started before uni when I was scratching around through the hard copy TISC book deciding what I was going to enrol in at uni. And it was between planning and teaching. And my grandparents had a family friend who was a town planner that was pretty high up at Department of Planning and said, oh, we could probably get you some work experience. And so I tried out some work experience at DPLH, and actually it was DPI then. Really enjoyed it and loved the diversity of the work. Things evolved from there. I went to university at Curtin, and Curtin now is WA's only Planning Institute accredited planning degree, so really the place to go for planning professionals. And then continued with work while I was at uni. So I started at Town of Claremont while I was at uni working, which really gave me such great hands-on experience and really at the coalface as the planning assistant at the Town of Claremont on the first day, being given a report to write for council and being told, there you go, as your computer, put it together. So that gave me great experience. I went on to work at the City of Mandurah as well and started there as a planning officer. I grew up in that area, so it was very logical for me. That was the reason I chose it. But really the benefit of that was the diversity that that place offered. And before you and I were speaking about interesting local governments, the local governments as a stepping stone in your career that are the most beneficial are the ones with that diversity of work. So the ones that'll give you rural residential or health or education precincts, diversity of residential opportunities to consider, mix of land uses really gives you that depth as a planner.
Some canals in there as well.
Definitely some canals there. Then I was coming into contact with Chapel Lambert Everett, it was at the time when I was at City of Mandurah, and they asked me if I'd come for an interview, and I thought, oh no, I'm actually pretty happy where I am, don't need to do that. And I did go for the interview, and then 20 years later, here I am. And I also did an MBA along the way as well, because I was going to be the CEO of a local government, and that was my career aspirations back in the day.
And that was a prerequisite, you think?
I think now, looking back in hindsight, I was just hungry to learn more about how business worked in general beyond just planning. But I loved it. I didn't do it at great speed. It took me about 5 or 6 years to do that degree, but I learned along the way and used practical assignments.
But you'd be quite unique in your field. I wouldn't have thought there'd be many planners in private or public sectors in WA where they've also got an MBA. That would set you apart as a leader in this industry.
I haven't thought about it before, but there probably isn't many. I went on to do the AICD diploma as well pretty quickly after that too, because I had an interest in business and institutions more broadly too, so that was really logical. But probably the other thing that gave me the biggest assistance in my career was industry involvement. So when I was at uni, I was heavily involved in the Planning Institute. I was part of the Young Planners Committee, and back then that was about organising social events. And
I think it is still.
Mixing tubs of sangria in my carport for boat cruises, which was great fun. But that's now evolved into being, I was vice president of UDIA for a number of years, stepped back at the moment given the other government commitments that I have on. And that platform of Planning Institute and then UDIA opportunities really helped my networks. And I think putting myself out there in uncomfortable situations that I call them my Brussels sprout moments, which you don't really want to eat them, but you just know they're good for you, so you just do it and it really makes a big difference.
And after enough of them, it starts to get easier to eat them as well.
Yeah, you find good ways to roast your Brussels sprouts and they're actually quite enjoyable.
And I think that's a theme along a lot of the leaders in this industry, is that whilst they're all very competent at their job, what sets them apart is their ability to build relationships with peers and essentially find peers that have similar values, same level of integrity, and clearly enough competency to have very stimulating, interesting conversations and then make a difference together. Because it's very obvious in this industry, you get nowhere by yourself, whether you're a developer or a planner or in local government. Whilst we might sit on various sides of the system, we all need each other to achieve things and fulfill ourselves in our career. So building that network, having people respect you for what you do, for how you do it, and essentially the scale at which you do that really does have a lot of impact as to the trajectory of your career and how much you can impact the industry as well. It goes hand in hand.
It does. And I've always made a point of seeking out interesting people and people that I can learn things from. I don't have a mentor per se, but I've got people that I can lean on, people that I can ask questions of along the way too. And then, as we were talking before, people that give you a hand along the way too. And I'd mentioned Gail McGowan as a good example of that, as somebody who really supported me through my involvement in the WAPC early on.
Let's segue into the WAPC. That's the second of the many hats you wear other than running a town planning company. What's it like being the deputy chair at the WAPC? What goes on in that place these days?
The opportunity and the privilege is not lost on me by any stretch. It's such a great opportunity and I really do take it very seriously, and the significance of it is really not lost on me either. The proposals that we have come to us, particularly through the Part 17 pathway, the State Development Assessment Unit pathway, are enormous proposals, and they're proposals that no planner in their career will get more than a couple of them to deal with, and I get to see multiple of them both in the metro and in the regions. Next week, I'm going out to see the Flat Rocks Wind Farm and have a look at the expansion of the green energy out there. You learn so much along the way. And for me, it's about giving as much as I can into that decision-making process to make sure that we end up with great outcomes in all of those decisions and pragmatic outcomes as well.
When you look at the system in place, the interface between DPLH and WAPC and the public and our expectations, what's your perspective on how things are performing right now and how well we're doing at solving these supply problems we've got?
I think that we need to look back at the last 10 years of planning reform and acknowledge that we've come a really long way. And when Anthony Albanese announced the planning reform agenda earlier this year, WA really has come a significant way and has got one of the best systems in Australia. And we are fortunate to have Minister Carey at the helm that's really driven a lot of that in the most recent years too. The opportunities now exist around reform of the processes, not necessarily the legislation, but internally, culturally within the organisation. There's some excellent, excellent leaders in at DPLH that really drive positive outcomes through the process, but we need the whole system to be humming like that as well.
I'm sitting here smiling and nodding my head because I agree. I know when you're saying there are some excellent people, I'm picturing them. I know the people you're talking about that are really high performers that want to make a difference, that could be in private practice but want to help at a state level and really drive the change that we need in Western Australia. Not just from a policy perspective, but as you mentioned, and what I think is even more important here is from a cultural perspective. You can have all the policy you want, and there's grey areas in policy left and right. But the culture that you have within the certain silos, whether it's WAPC, DPLH, EPA, the local governments, Water Corp, Western Power, that will determine where your outcome sits in the grey of all those policies. And I've seen very, very strongly how those outcomes can swing from left to right based on whether an organisation just wants to be on board or not, or even has the culture or the capacity to be on board. So I agree with you. I think that the planning side of things, the policy side of things, is certainly moving in the right direction, has a lot of space to move still on that. But it is really, I think, that Team WA culture of working together, the planners from local government, from state government, the developers, all of the 20 consultants you need to put a land development together or apartment development together. If everyone can work on the same page, and it goes back to your point again, networking outside of just business hours so you can just like each other for starters, right? And on a non-business basis, that I think is going to make a huge difference, or continue to make the difference that's currently being made right now.
The real opportunity there is for everybody to see that we're working for the same purpose, that we're solving the same problem around housing supply, housing crisis in WA, doing the right thing along the way, creating great places to live, creating a great environment, but that we're here to solve a problem. And that goes to that concept of brave leadership and brave decision making to get excellent outcomes. Not everything's written down in a policy or in a piece of legislation. We need people to make brave decisions along the way too.
You hang out at DevWA. What do you do there?
I do hang out at DevWA. I've been on the board of DevWA now just over 4 years, and I'm also chair of the Metronet East, Scarborough and Central Perth Land Redevelopment Committees. So they're like the JDAPs or the DAPs now for those redevelopment areas. And like the Part 17 pathway, the State Development Assessment Unit, I've seen some really interesting projects come through there. Elizabeth Quay sits within that. Seeing the towers coming through there, assessing those, the design considerations, the public amenity, the business opportunity that they deliver, really exciting to see. Scarborough and the normalisation that's happened through there. Most recently, it's gone back to Stirling. The decisions and make difficult decisions along there too, with an outdated planning framework that required some really rigorous assessments and really putting our mind to what's the right outcome in Scarborough has been a real stretch. But Development WA does amazingly diverse projects. I've been up in the Kimberley, up in Port Hedland and Karratha, those regional areas, the housing challenges, the affordability challenges, just the most simple things of getting a roof over people's heads to get the butcher, the baker into the town are some of the challenges that DevWA solves.
I think DevWA is an extremely important institution in Western Australia. It essentially is the entity that sponsors the delivery of housing in places where the free market otherwise wouldn't be able to. You think about land development in some of these regional areas or apartment development. There's not a developer in WA who can make any of that stack up. But it's the state government that goes in and goes, well, we need housing here. So regardless of whether it's going to cost us X or Y or a turn's going to take this time or it will take 15 years to sell or whatever it is, we're going to get this done because this is the right thing to do.
Exactly. Right?
And that's, I think, the function of a state government sponsored development corporation is that they do the things that the free market can't get done.
Yes, right? And there's some really cracker metro projects that are coming out of the ground for Development WA too. And Darren Cooper's the chair and can speak on behalf of the board about this. But from the public's perspective, the Ocean Reef Marina. Super cool project. It's going to be absolutely massive. East Perth Power Station's the next one that will come out of the ground. I think the whole of Perth has been holding its breath waiting for what's going to happen at East Perth.
Everyone wants it. No one seems to know how to fix the problems though. Or at least if they're... And those problems are being solved by the state government over time. But geez, I hope that gets done properly. I don't know if you've been to Brisbane, Jane.
Yes, I have.
But the Howard Smith Wharfs there are the crown jewel of Brisbane's metro area, sitting underneath the bridge, having a beer at Fallon's, walking around the river. It's phenomenal. And I see that East Perth Power Station as an opportunity to be that cultural activity entertainment hub that's connected to the bridge, connected to the stadium, that all of us can go to as a destination and activate our river. I don't know if you've noticed, but we have the least activated river in the country, totally tied up by R10 millionaire blocks. And you compare it to Brisbane, for example, they use their river. They have cycle paths running in the river, not along the river, in the river.
Yeah,
they have ferries going left and right. They have apartment buildings that thousands of people can enjoy the amenity of that river sitting next to the river. Instead, what do we have? 2,000 square meter lots facing the river. Yeah. We have no activation, minimal pubs and bars and museums. East Perth Power Station for me is the one opportunity we're going to have to create something that will change the face of our state.
It will. And that building is absolutely spectacular. You know, having been inside of it, the history that's wrapped up in there too, for everybody to be able to get access to that is absolutely amazing. But the benefit of that site is its scale and the fact that you can get something out of the ground there on the bigger footprint of the site whilst the heritage components redevelop. But you're right, there is significant opportunities sitting there with that river frontage.
The thing that concerns me is that we've had a couple of big boys have a crack at that. Forrest's have a crack, Stokes has had a crack, and they've both given it back. I wonder what it's going to take to get this site into the next stage of planning and development, because it is a reality. This thing's going to take many years, isn't it, to remediate not only the site, which is happening right now, but also the planning situation. Access, for example, off of East Parade, a perfect example.
Definitely not for me to say, and for something for a broader conversation with government, but it's about looking at the problem in a different way, I think, and how we deliver that site rather than the traditional way that we've looked at it. And there's plenty of opportunities there, and there's similar opportunities present themselves down at Fremantle too. The site that's down there as part of the Future of Fremantle project is the East Perth Power Station next level.
Before we talk about the future of Fremantle, can we quickly talk about Scarborough?
Yes.
I'm hearing all around the streets that we're getting to a point where maybe we're capping out on the scale of development that the state and local government are probably going to accept in the area. Is that true? Is there an appetite still for more development? I mean, we still see the Three Ocean site sitting there. It's a blight on Scarborough. None of us can do anything about it. But Gary Dempsey's got a couple of projects up recently in Brighton area. This is all adding more people and critical mass to what is continuing to be a fantastic destination in Perth.
It is. The decisions that have been made to date in Scarborough through the LRC process, and I'm not speaking on behalf of the board, and I'm careful that I'm very clear on that, have been made on the basis that we're working within the floor space that would be permitted but would be redistributed over the site. And that's given really clear guidance about height in that area. So whilst the height might be greater, the overall bulk and the footprint is not greater.
I wish more planning frameworks were open to that across Western Australia, to be frank.
Well, I guess that is the real benefit of a redevelopment area, in it being agile and flexible. And that's the value of those redevelopment areas. It was balancing that and the redistribution of the floor space with community benefit as well, and getting things like supermarkets and public open space and art galleries and shared meeting rooms and toilets. Toilets are a simple thing, but very important by the beach. Public car parking in as part of these projects. So definitely an appetite to see real development in there that maximises the benefit of the investment that's been put in there by the state. The next stage, though, now that the project's been normalised back to Stirling, is for the city of Stirling to start looking strategically at that precinct. Mm-hmm. A series of decisions have been made. The concept of the height peaking at the intersection of Scarborough Beach Road and West Coast Highway still remains in all of the decision making that's gone to date. The call for Stirling to make now is, what do they do with the planning framework and what do they allow and permit? So,
well, they have some fantastic leadership there. We got Steve Roddick as the CEO now. Amanda Shears, in my opinion, the best planning officer in local government Western Australia. Some great people there, but I guess it also comes down to the expectation of the community.
Exactly.
As well.
Exactly. And I think too, and this is part of that conversation too about us all being there to address the same problem, that we need to be talking to the industry as well in coming up with a new planning framework. So what is actually viable in that space? What can get out of the ground and what can be delivered? Because we're seeing Edge and Roberts Group that are looking to develop on Reserve Street to the north there, and that is fantastic coming out of the ground. But we need more projects coming out of the ground. So I think that the development of planning frameworks very much needs to be hand in glove with understanding industry and delivery as well. If we're not doing those two things together, then there's no point having the framework.
What does the future of Freo look like?
The future of Freo project is really exciting. So the Future of Fremantle Planning Committee is a subcommittee of the West Australian Planning Commission. The Future of Fremantle project is born out of the fact that a decision has been made to relocate container trade from Fremantle, and the timing of that will be determined in the coming months by government. But the questions asked, quite rightly, by the community, well, if the container trade goes, then what becomes of the port and what is left there for the community? And that's a 290 hectare site, 10 k's of coastline. It's intergenerational too, and we know that what we draw, what we say now, it's a land use and economic outcome, will not actually be what happens in the end. It's about getting the principles right, dealing with the decisions that need to be made in the short term. So there are decisions that need to be made around Fremantle in terms of transport and access in and out, more generally in North Fremantle. What happens with the relationship of the train station back into the harbour area and better connectedness there? What's happening in the heritage sheds through Fremantle too? And how we've seen Gage Roads, and everyone loves Gage Roads down there. How can we better use those spaces? So informing those short-term decisions with a long-term vision so we don't lose sight of the opportunity. But the community involvement has been fantastic through the Future of Fremantle project. Really strong, supportive engagement. We went out to consultation with three scenarios, the not so spicy, the mild, and the extra spicy kind of options.
So the Nando's choices.
Nando's choices. And the feedback that came back was, we really like what's in that high density option, that high spice scenario. Yep. Perhaps dial it back a little bit. But we also like the infrastructure that's sitting there too. So the community has been really aspirational with that project, which I think is a real testament to the community's understanding of the value of infill and development.
It's a fairly sophisticated market around Fremantle, North Fremantle, Mosman Park, these sort of people, right? They're switched on. Mm. They understand we need urban infill. Most of them NIMBYs don't want it in their backyard, but they'd be happy to have it across the train station on that enclave, for example, and go for your life. You want apartments, go for it, as long as they're not in my backyard, right? So I would have thought that makes sense for that market. But regardless of how it comes, I agree. You want to be creating a really vibrant community that has the critical mass of people and asset value to support some fantastic, again, amenity, local bars, the local library, the shops, all these things. If you undercook this thing, you've got one opportunity.
Exactly. And using the water as well. So we're not just focused on the land, but you talk about Brisbane and the connections across the water at Fremantle too. So we know it's a long-term play. I won't see what it looks like at full build-out, but it is the first stage in a really big, exciting project for Perth.
It's about being ready for whenever it is that that move to Kwinana happens. Is that right?
Yeah, exactly right.
And we can't really control that. And what are we thinking? Is it we talking 20, 30, 50 years, 10 years?
Timing's still to be determined by government, and we don't have that read yet. And it's very connected to decisions around infrastructure investment down there and budget and the broader transport network. Mm. But we know that it will come in time. We know that Fremantle can't cope at the moment as the functioning port. And it's not just container trade that's there as well. You've got the, I learned a new term, the ro-ro, which is roll on, roll off, the car trade there, and the break bulk as well. So a bigger decision needs to be made too. And that North Quay is really probably Perth's biggest cul-de-sac. There's a couple of roads in and out at Tideman there. It's a challenge at the moment for the freight and logistics. It is a challenge when it's developed in the future, but there are opportunities when it becomes a more mixed use, less truck oriented outcome that you can get public transport, you can get river crossings, you can get ferry, you can get all sorts of things, which will happen in time.
We're talking about master planning here, and I guess we can broaden the scope out to all of Western Australia now and start to talk about fixing our current supply issues. There's a number of master plan areas, planning investigation areas going on from a house and land perspective. It seems to continually be the path of least resistance to government in solving this crisis is to just keep turning to the house and land industry and pushing our urban fringe out further and further at the expense of the decisions being made to eat the Brussels sprouts, for example, which is the urban infill. I use that very deliberately. It is the decision between ice cream and vegetables, essentially, in my opinion, on how you fill your stomach every day. And it's always easier to eat the ice cream. And we've been doing that for decades. It seems like we're still provisioning for that in Mundajong, in East Wanneroo, Bullsbrook, these sort of areas. The irony of it is that I think most of us agree we need to start tempering that and bringing more urban infill into the mix. But we also don't even have enough of that house and land development pipeline, do we, to even give the kids the ice cream on a Sunday in a couple of years? That's the problem, is we don't have enough of either going on.
Yes, exactly. And the housing challenge at the moment means we need to eat our vegetables and our ice cream, the whole lot, dessert every day, because the supply challenge is immense. The key here is about, it's not one or the other. It's about both housing typologies can coexist at the same time. My work is both in a greenfield setting, but also in, and we were talking earlier about precinct scale master plan infill projects too, and other built form projects. They are complex to get out of the ground, but equally as are the greenfields projects too. And the lead time on greenfields projects is significant. In both situations, it's about running planning processes concurrently so that you're not wasting time ever.
Yeah. And having buy-in from each level of government as well, having sponsorship from the state government and the local government, and to an extent the community as well. If you don't have those three things together, as we've seen in, for example, Stoneville at the moment, you're absolutely going to be sitting in the water for a very long time.
What I would say, though, and to your comment around the continued expansion of the Perth metro area, all of the decisions that I have seen and been involved in terms of growth beyond the fringe, beyond the edge, have been very carefully considered and very strategic. They're around employment, they're around transport connections. Bullsbrook's a good example of that, with the significant industrial area happening up at Bullsbrook and the connection to that, so that you're getting people travelling both north to work as well as south. Looking at that Mundajong precinct and the connectedness back to what will ultimately be, and we come back to the port conversation, what will ultimately be Westport and the infrastructure that's associated with that and the jobs that will come with that too. So there is a very logical story to each of those growth areas. The Yanship Two Rocks extension too. We've got a train station that's just about to open around Yanship there. I was just up there the other week, and it's amazing what's coming out of the ground up there.
Isn't it crazy to think that only 20 years ago it was the Joondalup line? It's now going to be the Yanship line, and the distance between Joondalup and Yanship is longer than the distance between Perth and Joondalup. That's crazy to think.
It is crazy to think. So part of my work is on the Anship City Centre, and we're doing the strategic planning for the city centre at the moment with the landowner. And that is a super exciting project because in Australia, there's no other greenfield city centre project coming out of the ground that's got transport infrastructure that's come first as well. So the opportunity that exists there, and the landowner is thinking very differently about how to deliver there too, which is super exciting for Perth too.
It can't keep being your 350 square metre blocks when you're that far out, but also when you're trying to create an activity centre. And the thing that I think is always the most challenging in the house and land space is that the path of least resistance in the path of least resistance is just to do your house and land package, single story houses. But if you want to create communities, just like we're trying to do in an infill space, you actually need to create infill, in inverted commas, in the urban expansion areas, right? Yeah. Otherwise, you'll just end up with the same problem that you've got in, let's say, Hammersley, where there is just no infill, no downsize of product at all. You're just going to create that in Yanchep if you don't. But then the hard thing with that is, well, it's not the most economical thing to do. It's that more expensive per square meter rate. And the people that are buying up there are the most financially challenged most of the time to be a buyer in the first place. Why would they pay $600,000 for a townhouse where they could pay $550,000 for a house and land, or whatever the price is? That's a really hard sell.
It is. For the landowner in the case of Yanchep, it's about looking differently about how housing is delivered up there, and even at the tenure as well, so that you're not just thinking about green title and freehold sales too, but do you consider
leasehold?
Build to rent type models around that, so that the landowner can hold the land in the long term with a long term mindset. The other really interesting thing for Yanchep too is the employment incubators that have been established before the train station even came up. So there's the Y Hub that's up there now. That's got a honeybee CRC that's attached to UWA. City of Wanneroo have had offices up there. They've got a RTO training organisation up there too. So there are significant job opportunities and industries being built, and the principle is the extension of that innovation into the city centre as well. So just coming at it differently. I can't take credit for that. That's the landowner that's doing that.
Well, look, it's good to see that the landowner is taking an initiative in that space, because whilst the state government may prefer that they do that, ultimately they'll develop whatever they need to get supply out of the ground. However, we do see that along the path over the last few years, there have been estates that have been created that just are totally homogenous and provide nothing for the future. So I think we're learning those lessons as a state government, as a local government, but we're still going to have those conversations about certain patches. You could talk about a lot of Bold Ibis. You could talk about a lot of Byford, for example, where it's just all the same. And we're going to get to a point in five, if we're not already in some of these estates in 10, 15, 20 years, where downsizing just isn't really an option in those areas. And we've already built out. Another frontier, I guess, is East Wanneroo. My perspective is most of the government's eggs are in that basket when it comes to the next 20, 30 years of land development. That portion above Nangara Road and to the east of Lenore and Franklin is really one of the only spots left where you would see large-scale suburb-level land development. Would you agree? Is there a lot riding on the delivery of the infrastructure required to get these suburbs created?
I think the value of the Perth market is the multiple fronts. We've got the Northwest Corridor, and then we've got the Anship Two Rocks area. We've got Bullsbrook, North Ellenbrook precinct. We've got Wellard, Mundajong, Bald Ibis precinct. And then we've got Southern Corridor, kind of Rockingham, Mandurah. So there are a number of active fronts in Perth with strategically planned growth areas, some of which require more infrastructure investment than others, some of which require more fill than others. Mm. Nowhere is perfect at the moment. And I think that's the key, is that the easy land, so to speak, has been developed. Yeah. And so whatever's left is really difficult. And fragmented ownership is one of the key challenges in both infill and new growth area delivery. The key, though, is, and I think government has a real role in picking winners. So for government to take the lead on precincts, both within a East Wanneroo precinct, but also within an infill situation as well, and assemble the land, but drive the planning processes, drive the delivery, whether it's through DPLH, a redevelopment authority, the local government, it doesn't actually matter, but actually focusing on those challenged areas, because what we don't want in Perth is a single development front. We want multiple development fronts happening at the same time, along with a really healthy infill market with one day apartments that stack up and work and precinct-based medium density product that works too. And that would be the best outcome for Perth in making sure that we can meet the really aspirational housing supply targets that have been set by our federal government and also by the state.
It's interesting you mentioned that, is that real targeted planning, because Emily Young last week spoke about one of the PCA's main advocacy points is to get the state government to continue to work on early delivery of the future frontiers to make sure that we're not in a position that we probably shouldn't be in, to be frank, right now in, let's say, East Wanneroo, where we're still trying to figure out where the wastewater's going and how we're going to connect all the fragmented land and how the sewer is going to work with different contours. It's not easy out there. There's very challenging topographical conditions really to get sewer out there, and where is it coming from and all those sort of things. But you really would have liked it by now to be able to be developing in East Wanneroo. This would be a very good time to have a lot of those tracts of land available to the big guys in Perth to help solve this problem. Instead, they're chipping away at the last veins of gold in the mountain in Henley Brook, and a little bit left in Ellenbrook and the Yanchep and a little bit left in Baldivis. Does it feel like right now we really are extending mine lives, if I can put it that way, rather than opening up a brand new mine?
I wouldn't call them mines, but I definitely know what you mean with the analogy. And I can see, and the space that I work in, both in the infill precincts and for new growth areas, a number of strategically planned significant projects coming out of the ground, but they are in the 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 year timeframe.
There's a gap.
There's a gap, and it's not next year, and that's a problem. That's a situation we're all in, and industry is really pushing for quicker delivery, and in East Wanneroo is a great example of that, because there is that really short-term supply issue right now. And hence back to my comment earlier around the concurrent planning processes. We need every level of government to be working together so that we can get approvals out and the right approvals and the right projects as quickly as we can.
You mentioned departments just briefly before, and that is the second part of the solution, right? That is the broccoli to the Brussels sprouts, even less savoury for most people. It seems like we're still on a journey in Western Australia, both with the financials, clearly, in terms of making that stack up with escalating construction costs and a sales market that still isn't valuing apartments at the level it needs to get it going, but also culturally from a planning perspective. You'd like to think that the planning framework reflects cultural expectations, but there are some suburbs where I'd even suggest the planning framework is in front of cultural expectations, and obviously in others where it's the opposite. But unfortunately, the areas where the local community are probably not that against apartments and urban infill is where it least stacks up. And the areas where the local community are most against infill is where the probably the only opportunities right now to make it work. How do we start to solve that problem? Is it simply going to be a function of time of more and more people being exposed to different apartment buildings and realizing it ain't that bad and actually it's pretty convenient and I like my life and I'm going to make the move? Or is it going to take some real shift in prices for people to just go, you know what? This is all I can do. This is my only option, whether I like it or not.
It's probably a combination of all of those things. And for a long time, industry and government have talked about community education in that space too. It's very difficult to deliver community education in that space without having projects that they can touch and feel that are in their own local neighbourhoods. And the best community education comes out of the fact that their children need to buy somewhere to live, or their grandparents or their parents need a home to move into that's downsizing and there isn't anything available. So it will be a function of time, but I think also it does require, as we were talking about before, that brave, courageous decision-making, acknowledging that the planning frameworks in many cases do allow it, in some cases require some broader thinking and strategic thinking
and
about
discretion at discretion. State and local level.
Yeah, discretion that is very soundly made and very carefully made as well. And that's something that I have learnt a lot about in the WAPC and the Development WA roles, to the challenges of exercising that discretion. And sitting through and listening to the deputations made by the community, you can understand the concerns and the issues. And
it's mainly fear of the unknown.
It can be.
A lot of it's not empirically correct, but a lot of it is just, oh, I don't like it because it's an extra two stories more than the framework says. They're not following the rules. The problem is that whether it's by design or by coincidence, the current reality of the framework is that there isn't a project really in Western Australia that would stack up unless they receive discretion over and above what is mainly the issue, height limits in Western Australia, for it to be approved. It seems to be a system at the moment where the planning framework has not caught up with the economics.
That question, I think, is twofold. There's the need to regularly update planning frameworks.
Yes.
Which strong advocate for and strong believer in, but the planning framework can't update itself as quickly as the market changes. And so it's always going to require a degree of discretion. And the West Australian Planning Commission recently released a guide to discretionary decision making, which the purpose of it is to support decision makers in making those decisions where it might be outside what is written as a deemed to comply, but schemes do allow generally for an exercise of discretion.
Based on design principle. And this is what frustrates me, Jane, is that we set this system up, I think, to be an impossible work for most of the time. We want apartments to be more affordable for people. They should be. They are a compromise in living standards for a lot of people. But unfortunately, the way we work is we can't get a project to stack up unless we get discretion. But discretion won't be allowed unless you build something that meets all the design principles and is the next work of Michelangelo. Mm-hmm. And therefore, you're designing these buildings out of the price point of the people who would actually want to and be able to live in them. So the only apartment buildings that come up are these highly expensive, high-quality buildings because we aren't future-proofing our system. We're setting it up to fail, right? So in redoing our planning schemes every 5 to, let's say, Netherlands, 25 years, we have an issue in the first place. But given that we do that, we're also only just meeting the market or expectations of the community at that time. And then we fall away again straight away. Then developers need discretion. Why isn't there future-proofing? Why aren't we looking back? And you think about even, you know, I hate them in terms of their appropriateness for today's society, but you think back to the 60s when the BGC flats were built in Mosman Park, in Vic Park, in Maylands, in Highgate. These things were 14-story buildings built 50 years ago amongst a semi-rural population at the time, right? And look, they're fine. They serve a purpose in today's society for low-cost apartment living. Why can't we be future-proofing our infill system to not only incentivize it to work now, certainly, but to not have to be updated or given discretion for high-quality fit-outs in Cannington in 3 years' time from now where, yeah, maybe people aren't used to seeing seven stories, but five isn't going to help us in 20 years. We'll look at the five, go, it's too expensive to knock down, but it certainly doesn't serve our population anymore.
You make a good point around design review and the challenges of design review, that good is good enough in some situations, and perfect and amazing and international design competition doesn't have to be everywhere.
Not every building has to be a resort.
I agree with that. And I think that there's a need to carefully think about design review. And I was part of the WAPC process in reviewing the State Design Review Panel. And I know that now the next level of thinking is on local design review and what needs to happen at a local design review level and what projects do go to local design review. And with that too, that design review is about getting an outcome. The outcome isn't the review itself. So it's not about always doing three reviews or four reviews. It's about if you just need to do one review, then that's great. You just do one review and then you're done and you can get on, then you can get to delivery.
It's a culture of justifying positions, I think, in some cases, these design review panels. Iteration after iteration after iteration, which is not only time, but is continual criticism on what is actually, as you said before, fine. There's nothing wrong with it. When I think about Europe and the infill that they provide, I would suggest that nearly none of the apartment buildings being built in Switzerland, Austria, Germany, the Netherlands at the moment, England, would pass any design review panel in Western Australia. They are very simple, practical buildings. They don't focus on design per se. They focus on efficiency. They focus on energy efficiency and long-term build quality so that these things are still stacking up throughout renovation cycles 100 years from now. Whereas what we're building is flashy cars. That isn't going to stack up in 15, 20 years, but it looks sexy now. And that will depreciate very quickly over time as the next sexy thing gets built 10 years from now. We've built a culture of that. And I don't think it's going to serve us long term when we're trying to build affordable infill apartments, trying to build 300 apartments on a 3,000 square meter lot rather than 300 houses on 20 hectares in the middle of nowhere. There's clear arguments for infill, but we seem to be just continually biting our nose off despite our face.
I think what comes from that is the need to apply an economic or an affordability lens across every policy decision and planning decision that we make. And that doesn't necessarily just go with planning policy. That goes with environmental policy, with main roads transport policy. Mm. What impact is this decision having on the affordable living for the community?
And What's the upside?
What are the long-term implications of this decision too? And there is definitely room for that lens to be applied over planning decision-making from an economic perspective.
More pragmatism, I think. And the issue I think we see here, and it normally comes out of the fact that wherever the decision-maker is sitting, they're sitting in a silo. They're really not pulling themselves out of the position, understanding the holistic view of the market, taking advice from the other consultants in that holistic decision-making process, whether it's the EPA, whether it's the DPLH, whether it's the local government. When you make decisions in silos, you'll often get it wrong.
I'd like to think the decisions I've involved in haven't been in silos and we've been able to connect and reach out and understand that bigger picture, but I can absolutely see where you're coming from in those challenges, and I do see that in my day-to-day as well.
So we've spoken quite strategically and holistically about the challenges that everyone knows we're facing right now in terms of supply. Mm. My understanding, my belief is that we need to be providing at least 25 to 30,000 homes a year. And I think that's actually conservative when you think about population growth and the growth that's happening and the deficit we've actually been creating over the last 4 years in the first place. I think it really needs to be like 35, 40,000 homes a year. Mm-hmm. What is our current delivery capacity?
I think the challenge there is really understanding how much supply we have available to us. Yes, at least 25,000 to get to the federal government numbers. The delivery to date hasn't been anywhere near 25. We're kind of sub 20.
We're at 15 for years now. Exactly. And that, I think that's actually a more of a trade-based capacity rather at the moment than a land availability or even an apartment feasibility space.
Yes. And so the understanding needs to be developed around the amount of land that we've got available, the time that in both infill and greenfields, the time it will take to come to market, and when we can see to supply on that, to understand whether we can actually deliver. And if we do, as you were saying before, have that gap at that from now to kind of 5 year time frame, which I think everybody in the market is seeing that there is that gap at the moment in terms of supply. There are monitors that WPC have, the Urban Growth Monitor, the Urban Development Outlook, but what we need to understand is, including those planning investigation areas, including those future urban areas, taking those as case studies, when will they come online and what is the impact of not having them online looking like for the market? So a much more sophisticated system in terms of that understanding of supply. But from what I understand, across Australia, there are no other states that deliver a more nuanced understanding of supply than WA has. So it's a real challenge nationally.
Where does it need to be coordinated? At the planning minister's office? Who needs to be the person holding this Excel spreadsheet here?
I think part of the challenge with that is it needs all government agencies to come to the table, and it needs Water Corp, Western Power, Environment, Planning. So it needs to be centrally held, and we have seen the establishment of the Housing Supply Unit. That could be a core function of that Housing Supply Unit, is to really bring those agencies in and actually understand, because we need Water Corp and Western Power and other utility agencies to actually look at the plan for Perth that's been developed by the WPC and say, that is it, I am on board and I am delivering.
We're building a team to deliver this stuff.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And we're all on the same page. And at the moment, not my view, wearing any other hat than as a planning practitioner in the industry, is that we've got some room to move in that. We need to get a much better understanding of all agencies on the same page in terms of delivery.
What you're telling me, which is becoming more and more stark every day, is even the national newspapers now turn from being dovish on Perth to being actually bullish on Perth for the first time in years, is that I'm becoming less and less concerned about sounding bullish about the Perth market, sounding like a spruiker, and actually believing that by saying things such as, we have a very big issue over the next 2 to 5 years in the delivery of the housing we need in terms of the planning side and the labour force side capacity, and that that is going to continue to lead to price growth we haven't even imagined before in Western Australia, as being not inflammatory, but actually quite accurate. And even places like Oxford Economics in the AFR was quoted yesterday as suggesting that Perth's median house price, and I actually had to double check what I was reading was correct, they're firm that Perth's going to get $1 million in the median house price in the next 3 years. All of us with the houses are sitting there going, oh, that sounds great. But the rest of us in the planning, development space are going, that is the symptom of a serious issue that, even though we talk about it every week, is still being underestimated.
It is. And we have a strong government at the moment. We have a planning minister that is solution focused and delivery supply focused. Absolutely. So I'm confident that we are all heading in the right direction and government are heading in the right direction. But it's the pace of change. Like you say, that 3 years is so quick that I don't know that anyone can keep up with that. And that, going back to your point around apartments, that's the tipping point for apartments. Yeah. You know, when you get that median house price, and listening to your conversation with Rich Pappas and talking about the tipping point, we need that step change to get apartments
up. And it sounds evil, it's nearly like we all are on board now. It's just a reality. The market generally reflects expectations that before this supply issue was fixed, and as a pathway to fixing the supply issue, the Perth median house price is going to go to places none of us imagined. It's going to have to, not only from an economic market-based perspective to be able to actually get the banks to fund the supply we need in the infill space, but simply from an outcome of the clear pre-planning infrastructure gap we have, even at a house and land level, in the next few years that you've mentioned, as we start to mine out the last veins of our currently approved, ready-to-develop land industry. There is a gap that I just think some organization or many organizations have taken off the ball maybe 5 years ago, pre-COVID, that we're now going to be paying for at the worst time possible.
It goes back to the conversation earlier around the ice cream and Brussels sprouts, that it's multiple development fronts, it's infill happening at the same time, it's smoothing the approvals process so that you've got all agencies around the table, you've got local government understanding where we're going in the end game and operating concurrently with that. Looking at initiatives like what DPLH are taking with the referrals unit internally at DPLH, so that DPLH are taking ownership when a referral doesn't come back from an agency, following that through. And at the moment, that's been extended through the Part 17, the State Development Assessment, and the Part 11 new, which will now be Part 11B, potential to be able to roll that out to structure planning, to
every level. If you're not going to get on board, we'll step in.
And there's some real shiny examples of that at the moment through DPLH's activities. So the establishment of TAG groups, technical advisory groups, for key projects which bring all government agencies to the table. We had a recent example where we had 35 different people sitting around the table from DPIRD, fire, utilities, local government.
They always say if you want to slow things down, form a committee.
What it does is it means that people can't, maybe this is a wrong turn of phrase, but people can't hide behind the emails or hide behind the policy. They're going to rock up to the meeting, and they're also going to have to own and understand the same problem that we all understand, and we're all headed in the same direction. And that's the really powerful thing about bringing all those groups together. It then also means that as the proponent, you've got a contact at each of those agencies that you can go and talk to individually, and then it circles back to that bigger group. So I think long gone are the days of government bureaucrats being able to sit away and hide behind email responses. Everybody is part of the solution here and bringing it together.
Team WA
all the way.
Jane Bennett, thank you so much for coming in. I have to say this on air, you're probably the most impressive person I've had on this podcast for quite a while, and we have some absolute elite minds come on this podcast from around the state. Thank you so much. I thoroughly enjoyed this chat, and we could have gone for another hour, but please come back again and give us an update on how things are going.
Thanks, Trent, for having me today. It was really a privilege to be here, and you've added so much to the Perth property industry, so thank you for having me.
Thank you for listening to another episode of the Perth Property Show. If you've only just joined the conversation, you can catch up by heading over to our website, perthpropertyshow.com.au, subscribing to the podcast, or joining our Facebook page. Don't forget to tune in next Monday at 7 a.m. for more expert insights, local analysis, and suburb spotlights. Happy hunting!